Chapter 47. Jesse. Egypt, May 1916. Number 15, General Hospital, Alexandria, Egypt. Jesse double-checks the list of supplies that she is to purchase in Cairo. Not for the first time, she wishes that she had made more of an effort perfecting her handwriting skills when she was in school. She simply hadn't had the patience to perfect the loops and flourishes that Etta had mastered with such relish. A hasty scribble on a piece of loo paper was all she'd been able to manage when Matron had dictated the list to her outside the hospital nurse's loo. She tucks the list into her skirt pocket and taps the crown of her straw hat to ensure the pin is holding it securely against the gusts of the dust-filled Sirocco winds, a lesson learned when Mabel's straw boat had blown off her head at the pyramids and spun across the desert sand, its journey to Timbuktu halted by the Sphinx's right ear. She dashes down the hospital's stone steps just as the elegant lines of a green automobile appear on the hospital's drive, the car's canvas top folded back behind tufted brown leather seats. The driver pulls to a stop and leans his elbow on the door, the emu plume on his felt hat rippling in the breeze. He toots the horn and grins.
Well, well, looks like today's my lucky day.
Sergeant Winter. He waves his hat with a flourish.
At your service, Lieutenant Fry.
What are you doing here? I thought you were in Cairo.
We were moved up to Alexandria a couple of weeks ago.
He opens his hands.
Lucky you.
Jesse laughs. That's a rather handsome automobile. Archie pats the steering wheel.
A Vauxhall D, fresh off the boat from Blighty. The light horse just took delivery of two of them. The major asked for someone to take the old girl for a whirl around the city and work out any kinks. My hand shot up straight away. Told him I'd driven a taxi in Adelaide.
Did you? Really?
Nah, but my pa's a taxi driver, so I've been driving since I was a kid.
He puts his hand up to his mouth, as if revealing a secret.
I've got to pick the major up some cigars at the Greek tobacconist's while I'm out. Heaven forbid the major goes without his cigars in the middle of a war.
She pats the spare tyre affixed under Archie's window. Enjoy your drive. I have to hurry to the station to catch the Cairo train to pick up some supplies there for Matron.
Not on your own, surely?
No, I'm meeting someone at the station.
Well, hop in, why don't you? I'll swing by the station. Save you some shoe leather. It's too bloody hot to be trekking down there today.
He leans over his seat and opens the rear door, gesturing for Jesse to take a seat on the plump leather upholstery. That's very kind of you, Sergeant Winter. She steps onto the running board and into the car. I feel like I'm off to the theatre.
I like that you think I'll go to the theatre.
And the name's Archie. Jessie laughs, but her smile freezes when she sees a familiar, straight-backed figure step out onto the hospital's stoop. Archie squints at the officer.
You know that Arab bloke. Shouldn't he be back in the souk?
It's Captain Khalid. He's one of the surgeons. I worked with him on the Letitia at Gallipoli. I haven't worked with him here yet, thank goodness. He's the rudest man you'll ever meet. The doctor walks down the steps and strides around the car. He opens the passenger door and swings up into the seat beside Archie. He turns and inclines his head at Jesse.
Lieutenant?
Captain? He looks at Archie.
Let's go. We have a great deal to do in Cairo.
The train steams through the vast flat landscape of yellow-grey sand and scrub. Every now and then, a cluster of buildings the same dirty yellow, or a tall palm poking at the sky with its fan-like fronds, breaks the monotony of the view. When the train nears the Nile outside the town of Tanta, the flat, dry land transforms into vibrant green fields, separated by irrigation ditches shining like silver threads under the throbbing blue sky. A farmer in a wide-sleeved white jalabia carves furrows with a wooden plough, harnessed to a camel and an ox, as two children run barefoot about the field. He shouts at the children, but they ignore him and continue to leap across the new furrows as carefree as sparrows. Jesse peels off the cotton gloves that are damp with sweat. Lowering the dirt-streaked window, she then breathes in the warm air. She glances at Captain Khalid's reflection in the window. He is sitting diagonally across from her, reading, as he has done since they left Alexandria. The train lurches to a stop at Tanta, and she sees him turn his head to look out the window. He catches her gaze in the reflection, and she flicks her eyes to the station platform, conscious of her reddening cheeks. She watches the men in flowing jalabias and red felt tarbouches embark and disembark the train, as street sellers thrust oranges and dates at them. The train jolts and squeals to a start. Jessie blinks and presses her hand against her left eye. She blinks again, and tears well up, wetting her fingers. She fumbles in her skirt pocket for her handkerchief and wipes at her weeping eye.
What's the matter?
Something flew into my eye. He sets down the book.
Let me look at it, if I may.
Jessie wipes at her nose, which is now dripping in sympathy with her eye. Please. He sits in the seat beside her and presses his finger gently above and below her eye. His breath is warm on her cheek.
Blink.
Jessie blinks. Then she blinks again. And again.
That's enough.
I'm sorry. I can't seem to stop. It's scratching my eye.
Give me your handkerchief.
She hands him the damp handkerchief. He presses her lower eyelid open, and she shivers involuntarily at the touch of his fingers. She is engulfed by his warmth and the faint scent of tobacco. He dips the edge of the handkerchief into the corner of her eye. He hands her the handkerchief.
There. That should be better. It was a piece of grit. You must be more careful.
She blinks and wipes at her eye. Thank you, Captain. He sweeps his dark gaze over her.
I have seen inside your eyes. Please, my name is Aziz.
Jessie glances at the damp handkerchief she is kneading with her fingers. Everybody calls me Jessie, except for my mother. She insists on calling me Jessica. His lips twitch under his black moustache. He returns to his seat and picks up his book.
Jessica is a very beautiful name. It suits you well.
Jessie watches the Egyptian apothecary shout orders at two assistants, who are loading crates of iodine bottles and Dakin solution onto the back of a donkey cart beside sacks of bandages, handcuff wooden crutches, and canisters of nitrous oxide. She stifles a yawn and fans her damp face. The heat of Cairo hangs like a curtain over the bustling alleyways of the souk. At least it's their final stop. She couldn't swallow another cup of sweet, gritty coffee as the doctor and the various chemists and shopkeepers exchanged prolonged pleasantries and negotiations before the inevitable handover of filthy banknotes. A tap on her shoulder. She spins around. The doctor holds out a freshly peeled red fruit the size of an egg.
Try this. It is very delicious. I have just eaten two myself.
She sniffs the fruit before taking a tentative bite. A delicate sweetness, like watermelon, springs from the pulpy flesh as she chews. It's very nice.
It's a prickly pear from a cactus. They're one of my favourite things. My mother used to say I would turn into a cactus when I was a boy because I ate so many.
Jessie bites into the fruit and wipes at a trickle of juice on her chin. I had no idea cactuses bear fruit.
Not all, but some.
He excuses himself and walks over to the apothecary. A handshake, more conversation, and the slipping of banknotes into the man's hand, a slap on the back, and an embrace. He returns to Jessie.
They will take the supplies to the train. Come, you must be hungry. I shall take you to one of my favourite places here for something to eat.
Jessie glances down at the grey skirt of her uniform and slaps at the coating of fine yellow dust.
I'm not dressed for dinner, I'm afraid.
You are dressed perfectly well. It is here, in the souk.
In the souk?
Yes. Come with me.
Jessie stumbles through the jostling crowd in the trail of Captain Khalid, who glances back from time to time to ensure she hasn't been waylaid by an over-eager shopseller. The call of the devout to prayer filters through the alleys from somewhere deep in the souk. The hawkers shout from their stalls and cubbyholes, offering an endless selection of colourful fabrics, pungent spices, intricately wrought leather slippers, turtle shells and animal teeth, potions, honey-soaked delicacies and amulets. Blue smoke wafts over the bobbing heads of the shoppers, mostly men in jalabias and white skullcaps or red tarbouches, although an occasional cluster of chattering women in long sequined face coverings, their colourful dresses draped with black cotton cloth, elbow their way through the human sea. The rich aroma of roasting meat and spices sets Jessie's stomach rumbling. Aziz Khalid stops abruptly in front of an opening in a clay wall and gestures for her to enter. She steps into the shadowed interior of what appears to be a small cafe. A man in a white skullcap and a brown jalabia, which strains at his rolls of fat, shuffles over. He bows and exclaims in Arabic as he ushers them to a table lit by the glow of a wall-mounted lantern. The doctor pulls out a wooden chair and stands behind it, waiting for Jessie to sit.
Thank you.
She settles onto the hard chair.
I'm afraid I haven't a clue what to order.
Then you are in for a treat.
He turns to the host, and a debate ensues. After some minutes, the owner heads toward a back room, a satisfied smile above his jowls.
Please excuse me, Jessica. I shall return shortly.
She watches the doctor duck behind a curtained niche. The owner approaches her with a bowl and a ewer, a cloth draped over his arm. He nods at her hands, and she holds them over the bowl as he splashes them with a stream of cool water. She dries her hands on the cloth and thanks him. He presses his hand with its sausage-like fingers against the rolls of his chest.
Ash shukru lila.
Ash shukru lila, Jessie repeats.
Aziz hangs his uniform cap on the back of his chair and holds his hands over the ewer.
You've just said you're welcome.
How do you say thank you?
Shukran.
She repeats the word, attempting to emulate his rolling R.
Shukran.
If you wish to say thank you very much, you say shukran bezef.
Shukran bezef. Wonderful. Now I know some Arabic.
I would be very pleased to teach you more, if you wish. You will find it helpful while you are here in Egypt.
I should like that very much.
She folds her hands in her lap and clears her throat.
What have you ordered?
Ah, you will see.
You're not going to tell me.
That would ruin the surprise.
What if it's something strange?
I guarantee you will never have eaten any of the dishes Hassan will bring us this evening. So I suppose they will all be strange to you. Don't worry. I am sure you will like everything.
She scans the room as nerves jab at her belly.
How did you ever find this place? It's quite tucked away.
I was brought here by a great friend of mine, a Captain Lawrence, though I have always called him Ned. We met when we were both at Oxford, a very clever fellow, though he keeps much to himself. He is fascinated by all things Arabic, which is unusual for an Englishman.
He sounds interesting. I should like to meet him.
I'm afraid he's just been sent off to Mesopotamia. I don't imagine I shall see him again until after the war. He was just awarded the Legion d'Honor for his work in the Cairo Intelligence Office. An unassuming fellow, which I suppose is quite useful for intelligence work. You would never look twice at him in a room.
You said you attended Oxford?
Yes. My father was a member of the Egyptian government. He believed that a British education would provide me with opportunities which might otherwise be out of my reach.
Why would opportunities not be offered to you?
Because I am Egyptian. He holds up his hands. I have brown skin.
Oh.
My father was right. My Oxford education and medical training from Imperial College have given me the opportunity to work as a surgeon for the British Expeditionary Force. Basically, my education, combined with my knowledge of Egypt, made it impossible for them to refuse me.
I see. So, you know London, then?
Yes, very well. He settles back in his chair and regards Jessie. You don't appear to be bothered by the fact that I am Egyptian.
Why should I be?
A very great many people are extremely bothered by it.
Jessie nods, remembering Archie's comments that morning. Are you a Mohammedan?
He raises an eyebrow. That's very direct.
I'm sorry. Am I being terribly rude?
Mama has always said I speak before I think, far too often. She says I lack decorum. I sometimes feel like an ox in a china shop alongside my two sisters. Celie is full of decorum, and Etta is so... Well, everyone loves Etta. I'm sorry, am I rabbiting on? Not at all. In answer to your question, I am a Muslim. I left to pray when we first arrived.
Oh.
Christians and Muslims, and Jews as well, worship the same God. We simply call him by a different name. You are Jessica, and you are also Jessie and Lieutenant Fry. It is all the same. We are all people of the book.
People of the book?
The Old Testament. We all share it.
I didn't know that. How interesting. Though I'm not sure that my Catholic mother would approve of me dining with a Muslim gentleman.
It is not unusual to fear that which one does not know or understand.
Hassan approaches with a silver teapot and two tea glasses. He sets the glasses on the table and sweeps the teapot into the air with a flourish. Holding it aloft, he pours a stream of tea, fragrant with mint, into the glasses.
Jessie claps her hand together. Oh, well done! I would have had that all over the table.
Aziz picks up his tea glass.
I believe you are not one to fear that which you do not know, Jessica.
What makes you say that?
You wouldn't have become an army nurse or come to Egypt if that were the case.
She picks up her tea glass. You mustn't paint too romantic a picture of me. I'm rather selfish, actually. I want a life full of adventure and interesting experiences. I couldn't bear to be cooped up in a house like my mother, no matter how nice it is. I became an army nurse in order to travel and see the world. It was a means to an end. There aren't many opportunities for an adventurous life open to a woman. I've subsequently found myself to be rather good at nursing, particularly the surgical work.
Hassan looms over them with a tray laden with plates and dishes of fragrant food Jessie has never seen the like of. He sets it on the table and spreads his arms wide over the feast.
Bilhana wish shifa. He said, bon appetit.
She looks at the cafe owner and breaks into a wide smile.
Shukran. Shukran Bezef.
The rhythmic rolling of the train through the Egyptian countryside lulls Jessie to sleep. She jolts awake and glances across the aisle. Aziz is nowhere to be seen, although a copy of an Egyptian newspaper lies neatly folded on his seat. She looks out the window. Streaks of orange and yellow colour the vast expanse of sky, lighting the flat plains with a golden glow. Such a strange day, what with Archie Winter showing up so unexpectedly, then discovering that Captain Khalid, Aziz, was to accompany her to Cairo. She plays with his name in her head. Aziz Khalid. Then, that meal in Hassan's cafe. It would have been a simple thing to pick up some sandwiches and eat on the train. Why had he brought her there? He had relaxed in there. The line that etches itself across his forehead so frequently had melted away, along with the chilly reserve. He had laughed. What a surprise that had been. And there had been moments when she had caught him looking at her. Afterward, he had bought them sweet pastries called basbousa, soaked in sugar syrup from a pastry shop in the souk, and thick Turkish coffee from a man with an urn in the Cairo train station. She had enjoyed herself. It had been a very long time since she'd felt so light-hearted, so carefree. The door to the carriage swings open, and Aziz appears. She smiles at him as he returns to his seat. He picks up the paper. You were sleeping. I know. I'm terribly sorry. There is nothing to be sorry about. It has been a long day. Yes, but in a good way. He opens the paper, a whisper of a smile on his lips. I believe so, as well. Chapter 48. Seeley, London, June 1916. A flash of bright green hair catches Seeley's eye, and she looks up from the Daily Mirror, which, to her gratification, has published her article on Knitting to Win the War, complete with a pattern for a checkered waistcoat which could double as a chess or draughts board. What every frontline soldier would love in his comforts package from home. Her byline is still simply C. Fry, but she is a published writer and photographer. She must learn to count her blessings, as her mother had advised her, when she'd complained about being so cavalierly degendered. Millie? The green-haired girl looks in her direction. Her face and her hands are as yellow as lemons. Miss Fry! She tramps down the aisle and sits beside Seeley. Where are you off to? Oh, Millie, just call me Seeley. We are both working girls now. Isn't life a funny thing? Who would have thought we'd both be out in the world, earning our way, even a year ago? You look well, Miss Fr... She clears her throat. Seeley? Thank you, Millie. You, Millie laughs and pats her hair. Yeah, I know. I've got green hair. It's the TNT, what does it? Seeley folds the newspaper in her lap. How is your munitions work going? Are you enjoying it? It's all right. The pay's all right. 18 shillings a week, though after paying for lodging at the YMCA hostel and lunches in the canteen, it doesn't leave much for aught else. Still, it's better than being in service. Millie presses a yellow hand against her lips. Oh, I'm sorry, miss. I didn't mean it like that. Working for your family was very nice. Seeley smiles. I know Mama can be quite demanding, Millie. She has a very clear idea of how things should be. I suppose it was her upbringing. Her father was well off, and she was the only child. I think she was quite spoiled. I hope she didn't make life too difficult for you. She was strict, but she was fair. When I did something well, she always made sure to tell me. I'm pleased to hear that. I've been reading your articles in the Mirror. The other canaries are jealous I know a writer, though they don't believe you're a woman, even though I tell them such. Canaries? That's what people call us.
You can't blame them, can you? She holds up her bright yellow hands. Just look at them. The TNT dust stains everything yellow. All the tables and chairs in our canteen are yellow. We're quite a sight, but somebody's got to do it. It's not like we're sitting in a trench getting bombed and shot at, is it? I think you're awfully brave to be doing what you do. I've been feeling right queer from the work, it's true. I keeled over this morning with stomachache. The overlooker sent me to get checked at the hospital. It's where I'm off to now. Oh dear, Millie. I hope you're all right. Millie shrugs. Happens to us all the time. What can you do? Work is work. Her eyes narrow as she looks at Celie. Say, why don't you write a story about us canaries? It'd be nice for people to treat us with some respect instead of like we're lepers. That's an interesting idea. Who do I need to contact at the munitions factory if I can get my editor to agree? That'll be Dame Barker. She's the chief lady superintendent. She scares the life out of me. She troops round the place like an army general. Dame Barker, then. She smiles at Millie. How do you feel about having your picture in the paper? Wouldn't mean Mum and Pa be proud of that. She reaches up and pulls on the bell cord. Here's my stop. Nice to see you, Miss... Celie. I'm happy to help if you need. I'm at the YMCA on Manton Road or at me mum's in Poplar of a Sunday. Thank you, Millie. I shall definitely be in touch. She watches Millie stagger down the aisle of the omnibus as it bumps to a halt. Finally, she has something serious to write about. She will do the Canary Girls proud. At home, a letter from Etta is waiting for Celie on the hallway table. She picks it up and calls down the hallway. Mama, are you here? She listens for her mother's footsteps, but the house is heavy with silence. Once she is at her desk in her room, she slides the letter opener under the lip of the envelope and slices it open with a quick flick. Villa Serenissima, Capri, Italy. April the 11th, 1916. Dear Celie, forgive me for the long delay between letters. I have sent a separate one to Mama and Papa, but there is something I have been holding inside of me since Adriana's birth, and I can contain it no longer. You are the only one I feel I can tell. You are so solid and sensible, Celie. I wish, oh, how I wish, that I could simply sneak into your room and slide into bed with you like I did when I was a little girl. You always knew how to chase away my nightmares, when all Jessie would do was be cross with me. It has always seemed a strange thing to me to be Jessie's twin. We are so very unlike in every possible way. I must ask you not to tell any of the following to Mama and Papa. Please, swear it, Celie. Swear it on the Blessed Virgin. Where shall I begin? Carlo and I are not married. There, I said it. We are not married, nor does it look likely that we shall ever be married. No, he's not abandoned me and the baby. He managed to visit us here in Capri in February. He loves me. I have no doubt of that. The problem is that he is already married. He has a son named Paolo as well, who is 13 years old and lives with Carlo's wife's parents in Naples when he is not away at boarding school in Rome. I can well imagine what you're thinking. What an awful man Carlo is to have put me in this situation. Truly, it's not like that. His wife has been in an asylum for the insane for many years. Carlo pays for this and Paolo's schooling with the income from his paintings. This is why there is so little left for me and Adriana. We never did live in a villa near his parents in Naples. His parents are dead, and his father-in-law refuses to speak to him. It seems that Paolo was the result of a youthful love affair, and the marriage one which Carlo had no option but to agree to when she... Her name is Mariana. Well, You understand. He said he would find a way for us to be together after the war. It's all I have to hold on to. I must believe him. The alternative is simply too awful for me to think about. I've been rash and selfish and irresponsible. I know that. I refuse to consider that my actions might have consequences. I simply wish to be carefree and bohemian, like the people I met at Amiga. But now, I have Adriana, and she is my responsibility. I must be responsible, though some days I find it so difficult. I have not been altogether well since Adriana's birth, though there are days, like today, when I feel quite my normal self. I have days when I feel like a black fog engulfs me, and it is an effort even to open my eyes, and I cannot bear to be near Adriana for fear of doing her some harm. Then other times I awake with energy like I've never had before, where I paint and cook and take Adriana for a long walk in the hills. Those are wonderful days. But then the black fog descends once again, and strange creatures spin around me until I tear at my hair and fall on the floor weeping. Please, don't feel sorry for me or worry about me. Cousin Stefania assures me this will pass in time, as Adriana grows older. I do very much hope so, and it's true that the balance has turned in favour of the bright days over the dark days. In the meantime, her housekeeper, Liliana, makes a tonic of laudanum, honey and wine, which helps ease my mind so that I can sleep and recover. Celie, I have entered into this situation willingly, though I must confess that I wish I'd known about Mariana and Paolo when I was back in England. I believe I would have still embarked on this adventure with Carlo. What else could I have done when I was carrying his child? But it would have spared me the shock of him telling me all of this when I am so far away from all of you in London. Don't be shocked by this letter, Celie. I love Carlo with all my heart. You know what that feels like. I know you do, with your dear Max. You can see why it is impossible for me to tell Mama and Papa about this. They would never understand how love can sometimes lead one to do foolish things. Least of all Mama. She's had such a straightforward life, marrying a nice man like Papa, and living a comfortable life with her family in London. Wherever do we all get our adventurous spirits from? I am sending you my love, and look forward to the day when we can be sisters all together again, and you can meet your lovely niece. Your loving sister, Etta. Celie sits back in the desk chair. Oh, Etta, what have you done? What has Carlo done to you and Adriana? And now she is drawn into the tumult of Etta's life. The keeper of a secret she wishes she had never read. Chapter 49. Carlo. The Italian Mountains. September 1916. Carlo pushes open the asylum's tall double doors, elegant with their rococo carvings of seashells and fern fronds and panes of bevelled glass, remnants of the building's earlier incarnation as the home of a long-extinguished aristocratic family, and stands for a moment in the shadowed hall. Large squares of veined black-and-white marble from the quarries around Mondragone gleam dully under his feet, and the wooden wall panelling, once most likely painted a soft chalky white or pale pastel green, now shines with thick coats of grey gloss paint, so that the carved cornice, with its once elegant dentil moulding, sits like a thick splodge of frosting around the ceiling's perimeter. He walks down the hallway, passing doorways with their doors open to deep recesses of darkness. No one appears to be around, but this doesn't surprise him. He hasn't told them he will be coming this evening. It would be much better to be alone. He comes to the door at the end of the hallway. Like the others, the door is open, and he stands for a moment on the threshold as his eyes adjust to the gloom. Shutters obscure any moonlight,
though a chink of pale yellow light crawls through the shutter's edges and trails along the wooden floorboards, up the side of the narrow bed and across Mariana's sleeping face. She is like a sleeping statue, her unlined face serene, a tumble of dark hair curling like vines around her head, her veinless hands clasped together over the tumble of sheets, as if in the perpetual repose of the memorial to a dead queen. "Mariana," he whispers as he approaches. "Mariana." She opens her eyes, which glisten like glass marbles in the weak light. Her gaze is fixed somewhere beyond his shoulder, in a world far from the earthly plane. "Mariana, it's Carlo." Her eyes flicker, and he sees her vision clear as she focuses on his face. The graceful curve of her mouth turns up into the whisper of a smile. She holds out a hand toward him. "Carlo, amore mio." Her fingers close around his hand, cool and smooth as stone. "I have been waiting for you for such a long time." "Yes." "Where is my little one?" "Paolo is not so small any longer, Mariana. He is almost as tall as I am now." Her shining eyes cloud over. "Not Paolo. The little one, Gabriella." He shouldn't have come. He can see that now. If only she hadn't awakened. It would have been so easy to just... He lets her cold fingers slide from his grasp. He reaches into his waistcoat. Waistcoat? Where is his uniform? And pulls out a long silk tie. He rolls the two ends around his hands until the tie is taut. "She is with God's angels, Mariana. There was no place for one so pure on this earth. Wouldn't you like to be with her, my love?" Mariana's eyes flash as he leans over the bed. "Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So much, Carlo." He presses the tie across her neck. "I can help you, my sweet one. You know you can trust me." Carlo's eyes fly open. Under the wool of his uniform, his heart batters his ribs like a butcher hacking at an animal carcass. Above his head, the thick canvas of the tent ripples in the mountain wind. One of the other soldiers sputters and shifts on his pallet until he settles into a soft snore. He hears a bell, like a cowbell, somewhere in the distance, though he distrusts his ears. The thought of something as exquisitely ordinary as a cowbell in the hell in which he has found himself is far beyond his comprehension. He presses the pads of his thumbs against his eyes. How could he even dream of such a thing? His stomach lurches, sending bile into his throat. He swallows down the bitter fluid and shudders in disgust. Not at the sickly bile, nor the nightmare, but in the knowledge that now, after over a year of death and killing, he is capable of pressing the tie against Mariana's throat. Chapter 50. Etta. Villa Serenissima, Capri, Italy. September 1916. Stefania collects Etta's discarded coloured pencils and sketches from the dining table and hands them to Liliana. "Will you put these back in Etta's room when you have a moment, Liliana? She scatters these around like a tree shedding leaves." She holds up one of the sketches and squints at the half-finished view of the sea, framed by two of the balcony's vine-wrapped pillars. She gives the drawing to Liliana. She finishes nothing. Not even a sentence. It is like her mind turns so quickly that she is running to catch up to her thoughts, forgetting what she is doing in the moment. I found her out in the garden yesterday with only one shoe on, and the baby with no cap. I am not afraid to say that I am worried for her. Liliana rolls up the sketches and slips the pencils into her apron pocket.
She is like her mother. In some ways, yes. Both of them victims of their love for men who are not worthy of them. At least Miss Etta is married. Liliana's brow crumples into a row of lines, like an accordion deflating. Not like that bastardo who broke her mother's heart. Stefania glances at Liliana. If only that were true. I read the letter Etta wrote to Cecilia. They are not married.
Not married?
Worse than that. He is married to someone else, and he has a son. Liliana crosses herself.
Dio mio!
It is a disaster. My only hope is that he is killed in the mountains. Liliana's mouth drops open.
No, no, you mustn't say this kind of thing.
I know that. I shouldn't even be telling you this, Liliana, but I have kept it inside me since I read the letter. I cannot hold it in any longer, not when I see Etta sliding further away from us every day. I don't know what to do for her. Some day she seems so well, and then... If he dies, she and the baby will stay here, Stefania. I shall feed her well, and she can walk in the hills and make her drawings. I shall light a candle for her recovery in Santo Stefano every Sunday. The Heavenly Father knows I am a good woman. He will not refuse me my request, or he will feel the wrath of Liliana Sabatini when I cross through Heaven's gate.
Stefania smiles. This is a good plan. I have only one worry.
What is that?
What if he doesn't die, Liliana? What do we do then?
Chapter 51. Seeley. Royal Arsenal, Woolwich, London. October 1916. Seeley follows the crowd of women off the train and down Plumstead Road towards the sprawling site of the Royal Arsenal in Woolwich. She's been careful not to wear anything metal, as Millie had advised, not even her suspenders, so as not to cause an inadvertent spark around the explosives. She's had to tie string around the tops of her stockings to hold them up. With every step, she feels her left stocking loosen and slide towards her ankle. She stops abruptly to tug at the stocking. A woman ploughs into her.
"Careful, love! You almost had me on my head!"
"I'm terribly sorry."
"Should try wearing putties like me. They'll keep your legs warmer."
"Excuse me, can you tell me which gate I need for the danger buildings?"
"New here, are you? Fourth gate, at the end. Try to get them to give you a job in grenades instead of TNT. You don't want to turn into one of them canaries."
"Thank you, I shall."
Seeley walks alongside the Arsenal's red brick wall, skirting the queues of women and a few older men and young boys, at the first three gates. She spots Millie outside the fourth gate, her green hair hidden under a hat, though her face is still as yellow as a lemon.
"Seeley, hurry up! The train's about to leave!"
Seeley hastens towards Millie, her loose stocking working itself free of the string and puddling around her ankle. She bends over and pulls at her stocking.
"Hello, Millie. I'm sorry. I've had an accident with my stocking."
"We've all had that happen.
Just roll it under your knee for now."
Celia adjusts her stocking, then takes a letter out of the canvas bag, holding her camera paraphernalia. "I'm to show this to the security guard at the gate. It's from Dame Barker. I'm meeting her at the shifting house." Millie's green eyes widen.
"She's meeting us? Oh, my word.
Best get me nerve up, like I did when I had to vouch for her in her office. I told her you're Mrs. Pankhurst's right-hand woman. She was well impressed by that."
"Millie, how am I meant to live up to that?"
"You'll be fine, miss. I mean, Seeley. I had to make sure she couldn't say no, didn't I?"
"It looks like it worked. She's showing me around the danger buildings herself. She's very keen about this article for the Daily Mirror.
She said on the telephone that it was high time that the women munition workers were acknowledged for their services to the war effort.
We were all excited about it. Me mum's been telling all the neighbours I'll be in the paper.
Millie grabs Seeley's elbow and steers her through the gates. A security guard checks Millie's work card and Seeley's letter and waves them through. Seeley follows Millie across one of the wooden boardwalks that connect the sprawling collection of wooden sheds making up the danger buildings and into the shifting house. Inside, sinks line one wall and a sheet strung across the middle separates the room into two. Posters with "Keep Mum, She's Not Dumb" and "Gossip Cost Lives" plaster the whitewashed walls. Women chatter and laugh as they change out of their street clothes and into their uniforms of belted smocks, mop caps and rubber shoes, while two women overlookers in brown tunics tied with green belts check for hair clips, suspenders and jewellery.
"Over here, Seeley. This side is dirty. Over there's clean. Put your clothes into this kit bag, except for your shift. One of the overlookers will give you a uniform over in clean. You'll have to leave your camera here as well.
Oh, Dame Barker is giving me special dispensation to take photographs in some of the safer areas. Then she's going to gather the munitionettes together for photographs outside."
"Quite right, Miss Fry."
Seeley turns around to see a tall, broad woman in a smart khaki uniform. A wide-brimmed hat sits on dark hair as short as a man's. The woman's dark eyes appraise her from behind wire-rimmed spectacles, and she holds out her hand.
"Delighted to meet you, Miss Fry. I'm Dame Barker, the Chief Lady Superintendent here."
She nods at Millie.
"Miss Smith, very nice to see you again. I must say, it's the first time we've had a woman journalist visit us, Miss Fry. None of the other journalists have shown the least interest in our munitionettes. If everything we read is written by men, we shall never appreciate the minds and thoughts of women."
Seeley nods. "I agree completely, though my editor believes that women prefer reading about fashion and cookery to news stories about women at work. I had to threaten not to write about the results of the Daily Mirror's contest for the best mock cottage pie for him to agree to this story. I'll do my very best for you and the munitionettes, Lady Barker."
"It's a changing world, Miss Fry. I'm sure the Mirror's women readers will very much enjoy your article. I shall wait for you in the detonator building next door to the left. We shall commence our tour there."
She gestures to Millie, who is hovering behind Seeley.
"Would you like Miss Smith to accompany us?"
Seeley smiles at Millie. "Absolutely. This article was entirely her idea."
"Is that so? Well done, Miss Smith. Show Miss Fry where to change and meet me outside in 5 minutes."
Dame Barker points to a young woman working on a large artillery shell.
"Now, Miss Fry, here you can see this young woman fixing the case over a shell's detonator. The screws are tiny, as you can see, as is the screwdriver. It requires a steady hand and a meticulous vision. If she places too much pressure on the detonator, there's a possibility it may explode."
"Explode? Oh, my word." Seeley clicks the shutter on the reflex camera. She looks up at the young munitionette. "Aren't you nervous, doing what you do?" The young woman shrugs.
"No, miss. I do it all day long. Best not to think about it too much, though I heard of a woman who was expecting a baby tamped down too hard on a detonator. It blinded her, and she lost her hands. Could only feel her baby with her lips when it was born."
Dame Barker nods curtly.
"That wasn't here, though, was it?"
She looks at Seeley.
"We have had no major incidents at the arsenal, Miss Fry. We take great care to train our workers to ensure their safety. Isn't that right, Miss Smith?"
Yes, ma'am."
Dame Barker taps Seeley's elbow.
"I'm sure you would like to see the TNT building.
I'm afraid you will have to leave your camera in the shifting house before we go in there.
Yes, of course.
She picks up the camera tripod and follows the woman out of the detonator shed and down a wooden platform with Millie trailing behind.
Dame Barker, does it concern you that the TNT turns the munitionettes yellow? Is it safe?
I'm assured by our doctors that it is quite safe. Once the women stop working, the colour fades. It's simply like staining one's fingers with ink. That doesn't do any harm, does it?
I've read that TNT exposure can cause toxic jaundice.
I can't comment on that, except to say we have very strict measures in place to limit exposure by providing the workers with protective clothing. They must wash their hands and face whenever they leave the TNT building and must change into a clean smock before they go to their cafeteria. We ensure their safety at all times.
What happens if someone were to fall ill?
Our doctors would examine them, of course, and they would be sent to the hospital for the appropriate treatment. Isn't that right, Miss Smith?
Yes, ma'am. Had a bit of a rest. Now I'm fit as a fiddle.
Excellent.
Dame Barker pushes through the door to the TNT building.
Here we are. I would recommend you not breathe too deeply. Miss Smith, please, give us a demonstration of how you handle TNT.
Celie shuts the camera case and slides it into her canvas bag with her collapsible tripod. She waves at the crowd of munitionettes clustered on the wooden boardwalks in front of the danger buildings.
Thank you, ladies. I shall let Dame Barker know when the article will appear in the paper. He'll be famous.
Dame Barker weaves through the munitionettes towards Celie. She extends her hand and gives Celie's a firm shake.
It's been a pleasure, Miss Fry. The chief superintendent and the board are most interested in the article. Several of them remain unconvinced that a woman is up to the task of writing a news story.
I won't disappoint you, Dame Barker.
I have no doubt you will acquit yourself admirably. I understand you are Mrs. Pankhurst's right-hand woman, after all. Is there anything else I can help you with before you go?
Yes, there is, actually. I'd like very much to speak to Millie and some of the Canary Girls before they go back to work. Would that be all right?
Is that entirely necessary?
I want people to understand what a great service these young women are giving to the war effort and the sacrifice they're making for all of us. They should be applauded, not ridiculed.
I see. I do understand these concerns, which I agree should be addressed. You will, of course, write that the effects from the TNT are temporary and perfectly safe, Miss Fry?
Of course, Dame Barker. I mean, the government wouldn't permit it if it weren't safe to handle, would it?
Indeed, it would not. Fine. I shall have some of the girls meet you in the shifting house. If you could keep it to a quarter of an hour, I would be most appreciative. I have enough explaining to do to the paymistress as it is.
Thank you, Dame Barker. That would be perfect.
Celie shoves aside a stack of papers and sets a folder on the desk of her editor.
It's all done, Mr. Grayson. A full insight into the munitionettes at the Royal Arsenal in Woolwich. A canary girl named Millie Smith has given me quite a lot of help. Without her, I'd never have been able to get the munitionettes to open up to me the way they did. Please make sure you include her name in the article. I've included quite a few photographs as well.
Mr. Grayson picks up his pipe and puffs. He looks at Celie across the desk as he exhales a plume of blue smoke.
Your writing has always been competent, Miss Fry, but it's lacked heart. Am I to expect this to be any different?
It's rather difficult to get all that excited about knitting, Mr. Grayson. The munitionettes are altogether different.
These women are risking their lives every day to ensure our army and navy are supplied with the weapons they need to win this war. People need to know that women are capable of so much more than they've been allowed to do in the past. The world is changing,
It will never go back to the way it was. The editor sets down his pipe and flips through the folder, frowning as he examines the photographs. He picks up a sheet covered in Seeley's neat handwriting and scans the text. The men will want their jobs back after the war, Miss Fry. Women will have to go back to their houses and raise their families. I'm afraid I don't believe a great deal will change.
I do believe you're wrong, Mr. Grayson.
He taps out the tobacco into a brass bowl heaped with grey ash. You may be surprised to hear that I agree with you. I was at the Women's Right to Serve March last year.
You were?
I was covering it for the paper. The news pages, not the women's pages. It was very educational. Your photographs helped a great deal. You see, Miss Fry, I'm not the only one uninspired by knitting. He taps the folder. This is entirely different. You've captured a personal angle. A look inside the life of a canary girl. I like that. I'll give it a double page spread. I may need to tweak the title.
That's wonderful. There's just one thing, Mr. Grayson. I'd very much appreciate my full name on the byline. Cecilia Fry. How are women to move forward if we are kept hidden?
I'll see what I can do. And Miss Fry, you need to learn to touch type.
I beg your pardon?
If you're to be a proper journalist, you need to know how to touch type. Sooner rather than later, please.
Seeley takes a copy of the Daily Mirror from the newsboy in front of Hithergreen Station and drops a coin into his hand. She flips through the pages until she reaches the women's section. Canary girls fill Arsenal with song. Mr. Grayson certainly did tweak the title. What will Dame Barker think about that? She was awfully sensitive about the canary girls. But it's a two-page spread, including four of her photographs. A proper, serious article. By C. Fry.
Chapter 52. Christina. Marylebone, London. October, November, 1892. Christina surveys the table that the parlourmaids have set in the sitting room's large bay window, along with two Chippendale chairs from the dining room. The maids have draped one of her mother's best Irish linen tablecloths over the mahogany drop-leaf table and set it with sterling cutlery and her mother's favourite Royal Worcester bone china tea set. The cook has outdone herself with a selection of delicate crustless egg, cucumber and smoked salmon sandwiches, currant scones, custard tarts and tiny meringues topped with cream and strawberries sit on the tiered curate stand, like a display in the window of Fortnum's. She refolds the linen napkin and sets it back on the table. A rustle of silk and the click of heels on the hallway tiles. Christina glances over her shoulder as her aunt Henrietta sweeps through the French doors into the sitting room like a ship in full sail.
I see you've made yourself quite comfortable, pilfering our best china and silverware.
It was my mother's china, Aunt Henrietta. I'm sure you wouldn't wish Mr. Fry to think we are impecunious.
Her aunt harumphs. We live in Portman Square. I hardly think anyone would consider us impecunious.
My father and I live in Portman Square. You and Aunt Margaret are visitors.
Henrietta Bishop's eyes narrow. Margaret and I have as much claim on this house as your father, quite possibly more, as we are his elders. It has been in the Bishop family since the Napoleonic War. I was born in the blue bedroom.
As was I.
My mother was a Pembroke.
Christina juts out her chin. And my mother was an Innocenti.
A plasterer's daughter. And now we're playing host to tradesmen. It shouldn't be permitted.
The doorbell chimes. The two women stare at each other in seething silence
as the maid receives the visitor. Gerald appears in the doorway, nervously clutching a straw boater and a paper bag. Christina nods.
Thank you, Ada. Please take Mr. Fry's hat and ask Mrs. Cromwell to prepare the tea.
She smiles brightly at Gerald.
Mr. Fry, please come in. Let me introduce you to my aunt.
Aunt Henrietta, this is Mr. Gerald Fry, the photographer who took that lovely photograph of Cecilia and me.
Mr. Fry, this is my aunt Henrietta Bishop, my father's eldest sister. She and my aunt Margaret are visiting us from Yorkshire.
Gerald extends his hand, but drops it when he is met with Henrietta's stony countenance. He brushes his moustache nervously with his fingertips.
I'm very pleased to make your acquaintance, Miss Bishop.
Indeed.
The elder woman throws Christina a condescending glance.
I'm going out with Margaret to an exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery. I expect the house to be returned to normality upon our return.
She swishes towards the hallway, her taffeta skirt crackling like static. Christina and Gerald stand in awkward silence as Henrietta's footsteps fade.
I'm terribly sorry about that, Gerald. She is... well, she isn't the easiest woman. Please come in. Our cook has been busy all day making all these lovely things to eat. It looks very appetizing.
He holds out the paper bag.
I've brought you some chocolate cannoli. I found an Italian delicatessen near Farringdon Station. I hope you like chocolate.
Christina takes the bag.
I absolutely love chocolate, Gerald. Thank you very much.
Gerald smiles.
I've been looking forward to this since our boat ride in Regent's Park last week.
Christina opens the bag and sets the cannoli on the curate stand with the other delicacies. She takes a seat and lays a napkin in her lap.
I very much enjoyed that. It's so nice to have a nanny now for Cecilia. It's given me a bit more freedom. They've gone to the zoo today. Cecilia's very fond of the penguins. I'm very fond of them myself.
Gerald spreads his napkin in his lap.
I'm sorry to miss seeing her.
I'm surprised you still have a moustache from all the tugging at it she does. Really, Gerald, you mustn't allow her. It can't be pleasant.
I don't mind in the least.
I thought we might...
Ada enters, bearing a silver tray. She sets the teapot and jugs and bowls of milk, loose tea, clotted cream, sugar and jam on the table.
That will be all, Ada.
Christina sets the silver tea strainer on a teacup and pours out the steaming tea.
Just a small amount of milk for me, if you would, Mrs. Innocenti. No sugar.
No sugar?
You are modern.
She offers him the teacup.
I've told you time and again that my name's Christina.
She pours herself a cup of tea.
You were saying something before Ada came in with the tea?
Yes, I thought we might take a boat ride on the canal from Regent's Park up to Camden Lock next week. It passes the zoo and all the grand houses of Little Venice. You would scarcely believe you're in London.
That sounds lovely. I should enjoy that very much indeed.
And you must bring Cecilia. We can stop for ice cream in Camden Town. She'd like that, I'm sure.
Christina scrutinises the young photographer. He certainly isn't as handsome as Harry, but he is presentable enough. He'd taken great care with his suit today, a fine grey wool, which makes him look like one of those industrious young bank clerks on Oxford Street. He had been nothing but kind and solicitous since that first day, when she began to stop by the photography studio with Cecilia on her daily walks. They had exhausted the subject of the weather quickly enough, but there had been much to discuss about photography and Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee celebrations. One day in September, she had invited Gerald to join them to walk around the boating lake in the park, and this had become a regular excursion. Their meetings had given her something to look forward to. The world was somehow brighter on the days when they met. He was a good, solid, unexciting man. A decent man, and Cecilia adored him. She pushes the tiered curate stand toward Gerald.
Have some of Mrs. Cromwell's sandwiches, Gerald, and a scone. She bakes the best scones in London.
Gerald smiles, the corners of his moustache rising.
Thank you, Christina. I don't mind if I do.
November 2, 1892. Christina glances across at Gerald as the registrar reads through the marriage vows. Not a Catholic church, of course, what with Gerald being Protestant. Not even an Anglican church. A room in the town hall with her father and her scowling aunts as witnesses. It is not the wedding she and her mother had once imagined for her. He looks at her, and the corners of his eyes crinkle as he smiles. She looks down at her bouquet of white roses. Her heart doesn't leap the way it did for Harry. Gerald's face doesn't haunt her dreams the way that Harry's still does. But she could learn to love him. She would certainly try. That evening, when they are lying in bed after Gerald's awkward fumblings, Christina turns to him.
Gerald, something I need to ask of you.
Yes, of course, my dear.
I want us to be a family. You, me, Cecilia, and any children we may have.
Well, of course.
Cecilia must not feel like an outsider in her family if we have other children. I want you to be her father.
Of course I shall.
What I mean is, I want her to think you are her real father. She'll be a Fry, not an Innocenti.
Gerald props himself up on his elbow.
But surely she should know who her real father was.
He died a few days after her birth. You're the only father she'll ever know.
But she was born in May, when you were still in Italy. There must be a birth certificate. She'll know I'm not her father.
Christina looks up at the shadows around the plaster ceiling rose.
I left the birth certificate with my cousin Stefania. Seeing my husband's name on it upset me.
He pats her hand.
I understand.
We'll tell her she was born in May of 1893, rather than 1892. We'll tell her she came early.
3 months early.
If she ever questions it, I may need to suggest that we were eager.
Christina! Certainly not.
Gerald, I'm certain it won't come to that.
But she won't have a British birth certificate, my dear.
I shall figure something out when the time comes.
She looks over at her new husband.
Promise me, Gerald. Please. It's the only thing I'll ever ask of you.
He falls back against the pillows and stares into the room's shadowy gloom.
All right, Tina. I promise.
Part 5. 1917. Chapter 53. Jessie. Number 15 General Hospital, Alexandria, Egypt. January 1917. Jessie fills another bottle with a mix of warm water and salt and seals it with a stopper. Rain pelts against the tall windows, and she thinks about Clover Bar and how the sound of the rain against her and Etta's bedroom window had always made her feel secure and protected as it lulled her to sleep. She presses the back of her hand against her mouth as she yawns.
You should make yourself some tea, Jessie, Ivy says, as she folds a blanket over the foot of her bed. It'll help keep you awake.
Jessie nods as she stifles another yawn.
I shall. If it weren't raining so hard, I'd go up on the roof for some fresh air.
Is that where you always escape into? You wouldn't catch me on the roof for love nor money. Can't deal with heights.
A rumble of men's voices erupts from the hallway. A stream of sailors in sodden, filthy uniforms, many with burnt faces and singed hair, file barefooted into the ward.
So much for tea, Here we go, Ivy. It's going to be a busy night.
Jessie ties on a cotton mask and pushes through the swing door into the operating theatre with her elbow. A sailor lies groaning and muttering in Russian on the operating table, his left trouser leg sodden with blood below a makeshift tourniquet. Aziz Khalid stands over the sailor, cutting away his trousers. He looks up when Jessie enters. "Put some gloves on, then finish cutting these off, Lieutenant." He collects a rubber tube, a glass bottle, and a small balloon pump from a table as Jessie cuts through the blood-soaked fabric. "Watch me closely, Lieutenant. We need to do a blood transfusion, or he will die. I'll need you to insert the tube into my arm. Once I've inserted this end into his, I have type O blood, so his body will accept it, whatever his blood type is."
Yes, Captain.
He looks at her, his dark eyes serious above his mask. "You can do it, Lieutenant. I have every confidence in you." Jessie steps out onto the roof. The sky glows orange, and the sun sits on the eastern horizon. The air is fresh after the night's rain, and she breathes it in, filling her lungs with its welcome coolness. She walks over to the ledge and sits down. The muezzin calls out the dawn prayer from a nearby mosque, and she watches the city slowly awaken beneath the hill. "Thank you, Jessica." She looks behind her to see Aziz Khalid by the door to the stairs, his face drawn with fatigue, dark smudges under his eyes. "I did what any nurse would do." He joins her on the ledge. "Not everyone could have done the blood transfusion. It saved that sailor's life."
"I've never seen a doctor do what you did."
"We needed blood, and I have blood which anyone can use."
"What would you have done if you didn't have type O blood and your blood didn't match his?"
"I would have asked to test yours."
"Oh."
"Well, it wasn't necessary. I have read that the Canadians and Americans are working on a way to preserve and store blood. This would be a wonderful innovation. It would save many lives."
He gazes out at the city and listens as the last call from the muezzin fades into the awakening morning.
"You are a very good nurse, Jessica. I have been remiss in letting you know this."
He looks at her, and Jessie is suddenly aware of his warmth and of the way his gaze seems to probe into the very recesses of her mind. He takes a breath as if he is about to say something, but he hesitates, and the moment is lost. Jessie scans the sea, shining orange in the distance. She had expected something to happen after their trip to Cairo the previous May. But there had been no repeat of their companionable dinner once they were back in Alexandria. He had been nothing but curtly professional when they had worked together in the operating theatre. It was obvious he thought of her as nothing more than a competent nurse. It was probably just as well. Archie Winter was much better company. Aziz rises.
"I must go and pray. You should rest, Jessica. There will be much to do tomorrow."